Tuesday. C+19. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Dan McCarthy lay quietly in his bed, uneasily listening to news anchors surveying the damage from an unprecedented night of chaos as Emma Ford lay just as quietly by his side. The general story was the same across the country. Police forces had simply been overwhelmed by the sheer number of looters, a problem compounded by the geographical spread of the disorder, which made it physically impossible for law enforcement agencies to keep on top of everything. Tough, militarized crackdowns had worked in some places, where looting had descended into full-on rioting and arson. But on a nationwide scale, President Slater's promise of swift and effective responses to all instances of looting had been proven ill-founded. Dan sat up straight to see the pictures more clearly when he heard that a news helicopter was flying over one particularly badly hit area. "It's not so much that police have retaken these streets," the reporter said, "but more like the people have given them up and gone home." Although Birchwood itself had stayed peaceful, it had been a long and difficult night for everyone. No one argued with Henry's suggestion that they should all stay safely under one roof for the night, and it was agreed that Tara would have the couch and Timo the armchair, while Henry and Clark slept in their own bedrooms and Emma joined Dan in the basement. It had been well into the early hours when Emma turned off the living room TV and told everyone that whatever tomorrow was going to bring, they had to be awake and alert enough to deal with it. Dan agreed and joined her in the basement to try to catch a few hours of sleep. But although the others hadn't protested, it took only a few minutes for them to turn the TV back on. Ultimately, only Dan and Emma had gone to bed at all. Like millions of Americans, the others had been helplessly glued to their seats as the world they knew not so slowly crumbled all around them. Now, as the main breakfast hour on the news stations drew to a close, Dan flicked from ACN to Blitz News and stayed there for the promise of expert analysis on the potential societal effects of the comet beyond the much-reported looting of the previous night. Before that analysis began, the newsreader read a joint statement from Luisa Conti and Francesco Abate, in which the two media-shy individuals officially credited with discovering the comet broke their public silence to simultaneously hit out at John Cole's irresponsibility and call for calm. Blitz then took a quick look at some of the more out-there theories, which had gained a lot of social media attention overnight. A particularly popular one, a tamer variant of which Tara and Clark had briefly toyed with, posited that the comet might in fact be a misidentified alien mothership carrying hostile forces, who would launch an unstoppable ground invasion upon its arrival on Earth. The natural counterpoint that any hostile race capable of traveling that kind of distance would surely have some kind of cloaking mechanism, however rudimentary, was met with the response that the mothership might in fact have been disguised as a comet to misdirect humanity's attention and defensive resources ahead of the surprise invasion. More serious online discussions had focused on a very simple and familiar question. Why weren't the messengers helping? Although the details differed slightly, with the general public's belief that the messengers were friendly being based on the harmless content of the first three plaques, Dan's fuller knowledge of the messengers left him wondering exactly the same thing. As he thought about this, Dan found his mind likening the situation to a human cameraman who might encounter an antelope being killed by a lion and choose to stay out of it. But the metaphor didn't hold up for more than a few seconds. After all, the metaphorical cameraman in this case had already established his willingness to intervene by firing a warning shot into the air to give the antelope some kind of chance. Why would he help at all if he wasn't going to help decisively? No, Dan thought. It's worse than that. They destroyed DS-1, our best chance of saving ourselves from something like Il Diavolo, and they still won't help. This is more like the cameraman breaking the antelope's legs than firing a shot to warn it about a lion it can't run away from. And all the while, he just sits there and watches. Amid the fear in Dan's soul, or perhaps above that fear, to be more precise, anger was well and truly building. At last, after another commercial break, Blitz News finally got around to the long-promised analysis of the comet's broad societal effects. For all the station's faults, Blitz was normally good at this kind of thing. And as soon as the commercials ended and the studio returned to his screen, Dan could tell that the upcoming segment would be well put together. He recognized the popular scientist Penny Holmes and thought that the other guest looked vaguely familiar. When the host introduced her as a retail analyst and pointed out that she had been on the station in a similar capacity at the peak of the previous year's alien hysteria, Dan remembered it all. Back then, the retail analyst had acknowledged that shelves had been cleared of many essential goods while reassuring everyone that there would be no ongoing problems with the just-in-time delivery networks that so many stores, and by extension citizens, depended upon for their very survival. Today, her reply to a question on this topic was far less optimistic. "Well, right now the stores aren't open and the truck drivers aren't showing up for work. And as for sales of products last night, yes, I'd imagine that ammunition and everything else you'd expect to go quickly has indeed gone quickly. I imagine this, rather than know it, because this morning we can't lean on the systems which normally give us live data on buying trends and sales spikes, because looting isn't buying, and what use is all of that fancy sales tracking software when no one is paying for anything?" Dan was slightly annoyed to be hearing more looting talk when the opposite had been promised. But fortunately, this was the last time the topic was discussed. Penny Holmes, known to millions for her weekly astronomy show and occasional cameos elsewhere, offered some historical context regarding the public mood around the 1910 approach of Halley's Comet. Penny didn't pretend that the cases were equivalent. Halley's particularly close passage that year was never considered a threat by mainstream astronomers, but she argued that lessons could be learned from the hysteria of the time. "Comet pills, comet insurance, and a million other scams are likely to pop up in a bid to separate you from your financial resources," she told the viewers directly. "So it's going to pay to stay rational, and it's going to pay to stay vigilant." The mention of money saw the retail analyst invited to comment on the breaking news that spending on all major credit cards had been blocked within the last few minutes. Evidently, this was the first she was hearing of it. Her response was that people had to get ready to accept that the situation regarding this absolute credit freeze, along with the continued plummeting of stock prices across the board, was probably not going to get better anytime soon. The host continued to direct questions to Penny and the retail analyst in turn. Penny's next was a request to explain the concept of orbital periodicity and impact threats in the simplest possible terms. She rattled off a well-practiced and graphic-assisted explanation. "Let's say you walk around a parking lot once an hour, following an identical path. Now let's say someone else tips a bucket of water from the sky onto the same specific part of that path every 59 minutes and 59 seconds. It might take a while, but sooner or later, splash." Dan didn't actually consider that to be as good an explanation as Penny thought, but the Blitz News host was happy enough with it. "And there are some who think large comets like this have passed by extremely close in the relatively recent past," Penny went on. "It's not my view, but there are a handful of more or less reasonable academics out there who think that perhaps the only reason we don't have records of these long-period comets in the way we have records for short-period comets like Halley is that when the big boys pass by too close, those records, and their keepers, are eliminated. It's certainly true that indigenous groups in various parts of the world have ancient legends relating to comets as harbingers of doom in the shape of climate-related catastrophes. And another thing experts expect is that a decline in long-term thinking will once again lead to a precipitous decrease in things like mortgage applications and an increase in risky behaviors," the host said, following an earpiece-delivered instruction to shift away from Penny's crazy talk and get back to some less controversial retail analysis as quickly as possible. "Well, I suppose the news of the credit freeze answers the mortgage question, but what of, say, marriage rates?" As the analyst began to answer, Emma rolled onto her side and looked up at Dan. "Did you ever want to get married?" she asked. "What do you mean, did?" he replied, turning away from the TV to look at her. "You know what I meant. It's just like they're saying long-term commitments aren't really on the table for most people when there's no guarantee of any long-term future." "I guess," he shrugged. "But whatever most people think, the world hasn't ended yet. So anyway, why do you ask? Do you want to get married?" Emma chuckled. "Isn't there supposed to be a ring?" "I could get one," Dan replied, so quickly and with such a straight face that Emma was completely lost for words. She didn't want to say anything as potentially harsh as I was joking, just in case he wasn't. There was Hard to Read, and then there was Dan McCarthy. "I reckon all the jewelry stores are going to be closed until the future is a little more clear," she eventually said, opting for an element of humor. Dan's laugh, on cue, convinced most of her mind that he had been joking. In the less convinced part, she wasn't entirely sure that she wanted him to be. On the other side of the basement, Dan's wired phone suddenly began to ring. This prompted him to dive across the bed and lurch towards it to make sure he got there in time. When he reached it and saw the name of the caller, he paused and turned to Emma. It's Trey.
Pick up,
she sighed, rolling out of bed and massaging the area between her eyebrows with her thumbs, as she often did to get into a focused mindset for important phone calls. She outstretched her arm to receive the phone, and Dan handed it over a few seconds after taking the call. Trey's eager voice was already coming through the headset, mid-sentence, when Emma first put it to her ear.
"Hear what I'm saying? It's me, dude. Are you there? Listen, we need to—"
"And this is me," Emma interrupted. "What's up?"
"What's up?" Trey parroted, his tone a lot less calm than Emma's. "Are you serious?"
She chose her words more carefully before replying again.
"Okay. Specifically, why are you calling?"
"Maybe I should be asking the damn questions, like what the hell is going on? Did you guys find the plaque? Did they lead Dan to it and then point him to the comet? Is that what this is? And can you just hand over the phone so I can ask him myself?"
As unwelcome as they were, Trey's questions, and the tone he delivered them in, were only too understandable.
"Well, yeah," Emma said after giving up on the search for a better answer. "We found the plaque and it showed us where to look, but it doesn't seem like they're going to help us out with this."
"And they haven't contacted Dan since the night I was with you? Neither of you have felt any more of those shooting pains in your neck?"
"No, we have tried to communicate with the messengers. We went to the place they've called Dan to before, but no, nothing."
Trey was quiet for a few seconds, in which time Dan asked for the phone back and Emma gave it to him.
"It's me now," he said. "Just wait a sec."
"Okay,"
Trey sighed. Dan covered the phone's mouthpiece and turned to Emma.
"If they were going to come back, they wouldn't have let things get this bad," he told her, "right? So I think we should show people the plaque. Maybe even just knowing that the aliens knew about this before us could tell some genius scientists something useful. I don't know. A shot in the dark has to be better than no shot at all. We've given the GSC time to come up with something, but no single project jumps out as a workable solution, and this could be a relevant variable."
After some hesitation, Emma gave a half nod of authorization, and Dan told Trey of the fledgling plan. Trey liked the sound of it.
"And what about my footage of the craft? Are you going to show that too? Do you want me to be there to explain how you have that footage and how it didn't get out before now?"
"He's asking if we want him to be there when we show it, and if we're going to show the footage too," Dan relayed to Emma, who was getting increasingly frustrated by the lower-than-normal volume of the inlet speaker and Dan's wired handset, which meant that they couldn't both listen in at once. She took the phone and replied directly to Trey.
"We're going to do something," she said. "When I know exactly what that something is, I'll tell you. Just try to stay cool about this, okay? Don't act weird or tell anyone anything. You know something majorly big, but you have to remember that knowledge is power and power is responsibility. We only need to look at Cole to see what happens when the truth comes out the wrong way."
"Cole's a piece of shit," Trey said, venom suddenly crossing his lips. "I would never do anything like that. I'm not talking about going into business for myself here. I know you know that already, but seriously, fuck that guy, and fuck Jack Neal."
"But what kind of location are you thinking? If it's online and the media can't actually see the plaque for themselves, they won't believe it."
"Maybe the drive-in? Do you want me to take care of the projector and everything we had last time?"
"The drive-in isn't exactly the most secure site," Emma said.
"It was always fine before," Trey replied. "Besides, we're talking about Birchwood here. I'm guessing you guys didn't see a whole lot of rioting last night."
Dan tapped Emma on the arm and quietly shared an idea as soon as it entered his mind.
"What about the old IDA building? You know, where Timo was going to have the Fiori Frontieri HQ? The main entrance is ready and the press room has been refitted. The rest of the building isn't open for business yet, but we could definitely do something in the press room if we wanted to."
"Definitely not the drive-in," Emma reaffirmed to Trey while nodding at Dan. I'm going to look into the logistics of somewhere else. I'll let you know.
Today? Trey asked.
I'll let you know today, yeah. But we only get one chance at this, and I need to find a way to frame everything. So we'll say tomorrow for the actual reveal. Last night was bad, but the first night was always going to be the worst, at least until it becomes visible to the naked eye. I know a lot of people won't be at work or school today, but a lot of people will be, and they'll be back again tomorrow. The world hasn't ended yet.
Keep me in the loop, Trey said, and stay strong over there, okay?
We'll give it our best shot, Emma replied. And with that, she hung up.